Black Friday traces its origins to the 1920s and the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade kicking off the holiday shopping season. Cyber Monday, well, just the name alone dates it to the early 2000s. Giving Tuesday arrived just a short while later, when social media and hashtags became the favored way to encourage action. Charities and nonprofits are sometimes overlooked in the month between Thanksgiving and Christmas, and to counter the mad shopping sprees that were spilling over into the internet world in 2012, Giving Tuesday was created. This is the Everything is a Primary Source podcast, and I'm your host, Eric Paul. I have three podcast karaoke segments to present in order to recognize the day. First up is my conversation with Brock of the Prescott Park Arts Festival in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, recorded just this past June, right in the park, where we talk about, you guessed it, Prescott Park as a primary source. I have fond memories of this park during my childhood in the 1980s. There was always something to do, especially if what you want to do is walk around beautiful flower gardens, as theirs are the stuff of calendars and postcards. But then there's plays, kids' camps, music, photography, musicals, you name it. The park, like so many others around the country and the world, maintains its mission to provide a welcoming and enriching place for the public to enjoy.
My family's collection, he put it on DVD for us. And it's like a day that my dad had off. It was like his vacation. And so we rented a camera and we went to York Beach and filmed our whole time there. And then, as usual, we came to Prescott Park whenever we, you know, we're on a weekend in Portsmouth. And so we have this video of my brother and I running around. There's a tent set up on the other side of the park. And, you know, we're goofing off in there. And then, like, we're hanging on the branch of a tree. And my dad's like yelling at us. He's like, they're going to, you know, the mayor's here and he's going to be mad at us. And it's just like, that was just like one of countless times we came to this park for one thing or the other. And it's just such a wonderful place. And what is your role with the Prescott Parks Arts Festival that makes things like this happen?
So I am the operations manager. So, which is, I wouldn't say there's like one defined role. It's pretty broad. So basically what I tell people is that I essentially do everything that's not on stage.
Got it.
But also a little bit of stuff that's on stage as well. So Alexa McNamara and I, we both kind of run the show out here. We do the concession stand, the merchandise, yeah, all the site stuff, reservations, and kind of just making sure that this bad boy is running smoothly. Yeah.
Well, and it's the despite that it's like 50 degrees and windy, the smiles on people's faces says that you are doing it right. So what number Chowderfest is this that we're enjoying right now?
I want to say this is the 37th.
Wow.
Chowderfest. Yes. We had to skip a few years.
Yeah.
We had the pandemic, and then afterwards we were having a little bit of issues with restaurant staffing, and so restaurants just really couldn't do it, obviously for a good reason. But this year it kind of seemed like the right time to bring it back.
And the weather cooperated for hot soup. I mean, if it was like yesterday, it would not have been nearly as good. What is it that you would say, so, you know, like, you have right there a facsimile of the Chowder Fest, I think, from 1990. And WOKQ has long been the sponsor of it. It's like, I was just telling somebody, actually random on the parade route, because I was talking about Chowder Fest with them, and I have a recollection of going to one when I was a kid, but it wasn't here. It was, like, at some plaza, like a, you know, kind of a nice one, but not, it was like in a parking lot of a, and it was one of those things, when you're a kid, you don't really think about where you're going. Your parents just like drop, you know, bring you somewhere, and we got out of the car, I'm like, oh, we're here.
Yeah.
And then next thing I know, I'm like sampling all this chowder. I'm like, oh, this is great. Like, you know, and I assume that was the Chowder Fest, but it may have been just a Chowder Fest.
Huh.
As far as you know, has it always been in Prescott Park, or does Prescott Park have its own that it's like?
That is a good question. As far as I know, we're the ones that are putting it on. This is the oldest chowder festival in New England, maybe even the East Coast as well.
Wow.
I know that they tried a little bit of off-site festivals, but I think most of the chowders, at least in recent history, have been here at the park.
What does it tell you about, I think, Portsmouth maybe we'll just say specifically Prescott Park, that this isn't just, this isn't the only thing that happens here. And you get a great turnout, whether it's Chowder, whether it's a musical. What does that tell you about the park's role in Portsmouth culture?
Yeah, that's a good question. So Prescott Park Arts Festival is, a lot of times, just like yourself, is kind of their first stepping stone into the art culture,
yeah,
in the art experience. So a lot of people, like, we talk to people all the time and that are in their 50s and 60s that are saying that this is where they came when they were a kid, and this is their first experience into art. And whenever I do a lot of the hiring, Alexa and I do hiring for the seasonal staff, and we always ask the same question, which is, do you have a favorite memory at the festival? And everybody always has, like, something very specific to say, and they're like, and they're always different, which is really interesting to me, is that you think about, you see all the kids walking around here right now, it's like, I wonder how many of them are going to be bringing their
friends
to the festival one day to get their first their first take of a musical or a concert or anything like that.
It's such a, and it's like, you know, I posted on Instagram about it recently, about just the, you know, the, a very short version of the story of how this park came to be. I was surprised when I was old enough to, you know anything about this stuff, that this wasn't always a park. Like, I always pictured it like 18th century, you know, like people, you know, promenading around the, and the truth of the matter, it was like a wharf then, and then by the 20th century it had turned into like a junkyard and wasn't really quite the cultural centerpiece that you're talking about, but we're glad that it is, and it doesn't look like it's ever going to turn back, you know, because people, one of the bumper stickers that you hooked me up with, it's probably buried right now just to, doesn't blow away, it says, it, and I think it's from like the 80s or something, it says like, it's not summer, and then just dot dot dot, and it's like Prescott Park Arts Festival, and it's like, yeah, it's not, it's not summer without this. And what does that tell you about this, to broaden it up as a community? What does it tell you about Portsmouth specifically, that it isn't summer without at least a few visits to the park for one reason or another?
Yeah, it does feel like a summer in Portsmouth is synonymous with Prescott Park Arts Festival. It just feels like once the first show starts, that's like when it feels like it's going to be the first day of summer, realistically, for this area, you know, the seacoast. It's just one of those things where, you know, we're working a lot of hours here, all the staff here is working a lot of hours, but there's just no better way, like no other way that we would like to spend our summer, just out here in the park all day. The city, we get a lot of support from the city, and it's like all our donors, all the organizations and businesses, it's just like a big team. And, you know, obviously we have a small staff with the festival, but really it's the whole city of Portsmouth, it's the seacoast that puts us down, and we couldn't do it without the support of everyone involved.
It's it really is a testament. So to, you know, when they put a musical on here, it's, you have to, you know, people start putting their blankets out at like 11 in the morning for an evening show, because, and if you show up anytime, you know, late-ish, you're sitting all the way back, you know, where we are right now, you can't even see the stage. And it's just like, that is, I know it's replicated throughout the country, there's other parks and, you know, waterfronts and stuff like that, but this one just has always seemed so genuine. And I think that's what, I had a student in my class a couple years ago, he's in a local history class, and my last question was, and I brought it to New Hampshire, but I think Portsmouth is like, you know, 400 years old, so it very much fits the bill, you know, kind of covers it all, of like, how would you describe New Hampshire? Like one word, or, and he said, New Hampshire is genuine. New Hampshire is a real place. It's like authentic. Everything is, nothing's prepackaged. Nothing is, you know, slapped together. And, you know, looking around, just like, even though like these trees were planted for the park and the walkways were designed. But it seems just so much more real. Like the bricks are a little bit crooked here and there, and there's you know little pathways that are carved out because people have just gone that way, and it's not an official, you know, path or whatever. You just you know I love that the whale sculpture that's over there. No real explanation to it. It's not like it had, but you know I can tell you how many pictures I took on that when I was a kid, and I can tell you how hot it gets in the summertime when you're wearing your shorts. Would you agree with that? That this park is just one of many examples of the authentic nature that is Portsmouth and New Hampshire in general.
Yeah, that's something I say to people all the time, and it's the festival, this park, it feels like it kind of has a soul.
Yeah.
Like it is like a living thing, and it's one of those things, and it's like when all the staff is gone, there'll be a new staff and it'll still be around, and it's very much of a part of Portsmouth and Seacoast life, and it kind of just feels like, and like you said, it's just, there's definitely
That's authentic too.
Sorry about that. I had some radio.
So. That's fine.
It just feels like it has a lot of character.
Yeah.
And
I love the corners of the park. It has so many different. It's not a big park by you know park standards.
It really is
on the smaller side, but. It's the nooks and crannies and just like the sections of it. You got the gardens in one spot. You got the gondola park nearby. You got the, you know, where we are, the fountain over there.
Yeah. Do you know what this building that you're sitting next to is called?
No.
It's, I don't know if it's officially called this, but at the festival, it's called the Squirrel Shed.
Really? Because I assume they've made a home out of it?
I personally have never seen a squirrel in this shed.
I saw a bunny jumping out of here earlier today.
I know. I think I've seen lots of bunnies, so maybe we should rename it the Bunny Shed. But this has been around for a long time, and we use it just for storage. But this in itself is just like what you're kind of what you're talking about. It's like it seems like every part of the park has its own like flavor.
Yeah, like you could almost like a Mr. Rogers neighborhood type thing with just Prescott Park. Like you know, visit the squirrels over here, and then the, you know, go to. It seemed like for a while in the 80s, my brother used to joke that there was always a guy that looked like Gallagher the comedian on roller skates. Like it was just like that kind of place where. You know, the 70s are still alive, even though it was like 1989. You know, guys like bell bottoms, like dancing around and, you know, boom boxes and stuff like that. Yeah. And, you know, it's like, it has, I love that character. It just has like that, and it's almost like the entire city is informing the character of it. Like even the fountain over there, that memorial fountain, came from another part of town, you know, from the, you know, the federal building area and then, you know, brought that over here. And then the gardens are tended by, you know, all sorts of people. So it's just like the most organic version of the city is just kind of like on display where it should be, right on the waterfront. So how would you rate, because the chowder probably went pretty quick again this year.
Yeah, it did. Yeah.
Is that something that is just kind of like, you know, baked into the thing where you're like, yeah, it's gonna go in about half an hour.
We tried something a little bit different this year. So everybody who bought tickets definitely would try every chowder. So we did a little bit of smaller cups this year, and we did some stamp cards. That way everybody can try out the chowder. But typically in the past, it's like, it goes.
Yeah.
It goes in, and once it's gone, it's gone. And yeah.
I bet the restaurants enjoy being able to market themselves and have everybody you know, coming around.
I think that's like super something to talk about is that the restaurants are supplying their own chowder, their equipment, their own staff. Like they're not really, they're just doing it to be a part of the community. And we really just like really appreciate their support.
Portsmouth is definitely a great foodie town.
Yeah.
It always has been, but even better nowadays. And I'm so glad that things are back to normal in that regard because I remember hearing, you know, a lot of business owners and a lot of restaurant owners all around the country were not enjoying pandemic rules and stuff like that.
Yep.
But it seemed like Portsmouth in particular, which has always really relied on the unique buildings that they occupy as being part of the experience of dining.
Yeah.
We're like, oh, we need to get, you know, this place back open again because, you know, so it's glad to see them back to normal. And then, you know, having those additional, like, if they didn't have outdoor seating before, they have it now, and it just adds more to the experience. And I love walking around downtown and getting all the smells from the different restaurants and everything like that. And whenever I come to town, I usually start and end my day here at Prescott Park. It's like I'll park somewhere near Strawberry Bank and then, you know, kind of make my way through the park. And my son loves doing, like, Pokemon Go or the Jurassic World, you know, thing, the altered reality, you know, games through the park. And yeah, it's always just a great day. And so I appreciate, the weather's not great today, but it's still a great day. So I appreciate
you doing it. It's perfect weather for chowder.
It is. You couldn't have asked for that. I think yesterday would have been awful. Yeah. You know, nobody would have wanted, like, oh, hot soup and it's 90 degrees. Perfect. Yeah. But on a day like this, it does fit the bill pretty well. So thanks for stopping by.
Portsmouth celebrated its 400th birthday all year in 2023. It'll be just a little bit longer until Exeter, another Seacoast region town, and the setting for the next segment will have its quadrant centennial. But when it does come in 2038, you can be sure that the American Independence Museum will have a major role in the celebration. I spoke with Museum Director Jennifer Carr on Exeter's Independence Day. It's a celebration of the Declaration of Independence, just the same as the 4th of July for the whole country, except a week and a half later. Take a listen to our conversation to learn more.
I'm sure you're familiar, just from probably fourth or fifth grade history class, that during the Revolutionary War, as a more of like a safety measure, because Portsmouth was the capital, to put it further inland, Exeter became the capital. But actually nailing down the official business building is kind of hard to do. The museum, what buildings constitute the museum here in Exeter?
We have two 18th century buildings. The first one is the Ladd Gilman House, built in 1721. And during the American Revolution, that building was used as the state treasury. Later on in the 19th century, it would be used as the governor's mansion. New Hampshire's longest serving governor, John Taylor Gilman, was born and lived in this house. And we then have the Folsom Tavern, built in 1775. And that was a working tavern. It was very high end at the time. It was owned by Samuel Folsom, who was a patriot. And the Committee of Safety also met there during the American Revolution. It also was the site of the foundation of the Society of the Cincinnati in the state of New Hampshire, which is America's oldest veterans organization. And George Washington ate breakfast there. So a lot of history.
Was that during his visit to the area as president?
Yes, his tour of the northern states in 1789, shortly after he was elected.
So I used to do live living history, not quite reenactment, but first-person interpreting at Strawberry Bank, which has the Stavers Tavern, or the also known as the William Pitt Tavern, which there's a famous story. It's been kind of muddled through history, changed around a little bit, but the bottom line is that John Stavers Sr., who was a suspected Tory, was apprehended at his hotel and brought here to Exeter, and then his son, who's the one I portrayed, had to come to Exeter, and I'm assuming if the Committee of Safety met here, because they're the ones who arrested him, probably had to meet with them and get him bailed out and brought home.
Right.
And so it was like tavern to tavern. Taverns really did play a huge role in everyday life in the 18th century, didn't
they? A huge role, yes. They were gathering places, just as taverns are today. They were places where you could get food and lodging, but they were also places where revolutionary activity was planned and sometimes executed. Mm-hmm. So they were very significant to the American Revolution, for sure.
And especially considering what a cultural hub they had become in each of these, you know, pretty small-sized towns. Exeter is now and was then much smaller than Portsmouth.
Yes.
So they probably had even more of a close-knit community that would utilize taverns in that manner. And it's funny that you say that about Gilman's tavern as being higher end, but he was a patriot.
Stavers was considered higher end in Portsmouth, but like I said, he was considered or thought to be a British sympathizer for the same reasons, because he catered to the wealthy elite. So it seemed like hugging the coastline, the wealthy elite tended to be Tory, but inland a little bit more, they might not be as much.
Yeah, Exeter was definitely a patriot town. But what's interesting about the Gilman family is we had part of the Gilman family lived in the Lat Gilman house here on our grounds. But there's also the Gilman Garrison house, which is just down the street from us. And they were cousins to the Gilmans who live here. And the Gilmans who lived at the Gilman Garrison house are known to be loyalists. So the family was a little bit divided. But from what I understand, even though this was strongly a patriot town, they sort of had respect for the loyalist Gilmans. Mm-hmm. It didn't give them much trouble. Nobody got tarred and feathered, as far as I know.
And behind us are some British troops, so that would be to ensure that there wouldn't be tarring and feathering going on, because they're doing some kind of muster with the kids right now. Tell me a little bit about the museum itself. When did this building open up as the American Independence Museum?
This opened in 1991. And the story behind that is really interesting. This house was being used as the headquarters for the Society of the Cincinnati in the state of New Hampshire. It's still the headquarters for the society. But there was a society member doing some work in the attic in 1985, and he found a document that he thought maybe might look authentic. It was a copy of the Declaration of Independence. And so they took it to some experts and had it authenticated, and it turned out it was an original 1776 Dunlap broadside printing of the Declaration of Independence, which was distributed to all of the colonies on July 4th, 1776. And the story goes that there was a bit of a fight with the state over who had ownership of the document. And in the end, they decided that the society would maintain possession of the document under the condition that it be made available to the public. And so the society decided to turn their headquarters into an educational center to share the Dunlap broadside with the public. And then we opened to the public in 1991, and that's why.
Okay, so this event today... Oh, perfect. The guy just walked by with a Cincinnati shirt. I really shouldn't do that. It's such an audio medium of pointing things out that I can see to people. But so this event coincides with the museum. This is kind of like the core reason for the museum's existence, is to celebrate that connection to the Declaration of Independence that it has.
Absolutely. And we're a little bit unusual in Exeter in that we don't celebrate the 4th of July like most towns do. Mm-hmm. We celebrate independence on the Saturday that's closest to the day that the Dunlap broadside arrived here, which was July 16th, 1776. So we always celebrate in mid-July instead of July 4th. And yes, that is it's core to our mission and to our existence, absolutely.
It's, the Declaration of Independence is probably the very first example of American pop culture, because it was, even though it was forged in Philadelphia, there was a lot of hands involved in it, you know, but it was made there, but then broadcast around the rest of the country. And, you know, it was received differently depending on who you were and what your, you know, feelings about the matter was, but it finally put an actual mission to what was going on. And it seems like everything else, you know, that came afterwards is a product in some shape or form of the Declaration of Independence. That, you know, I brought a copy of the, this is laminated, so I hope it's not a real one. I don't think they usually put people's pictures in the, you know, on Declaration of Sentiments, but this is the, you know, from 1848, the Women's Convention, Women's Rights Convention in Seneca Falls, New York, where it's almost word for word, when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one portion of the family, you know, so they went line by line with their Declaration of Sentiments, sometimes called the Women's Declaration of Independence, to the Declaration of Independence, not necessarily because they were trying to ride coattails or step on toes or anything, more because they knew that everybody knew that other one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that in, you know, every school, even at home when you were teaching kids, that's how they learned pretty much, you know, how to read and write and to just recite things, that their message would go over that much better if it was a familiar language rather than something totally brand new.
Right.
Do you find when people visit the museum that the Declaration of Independence is still very well known, that people could... It's like, oh, I remember reciting that in school myself. Does that happen a lot?
Yeah, I think so. But I think what's interesting is most people know the beginning and most people know the end. But there's a whole lot in the middle that I think people are surprised by, and sometimes surprised by how very, very long it is. We just had a reading of the Declaration this morning by a descendant of the man who read it in 1776. Oh, nice. And it takes a long time to read. It's like a 45-minute read. So
once
I think that surprises people.
Get to the allegations against the king. He has. That's when it gets kind of like long.
Yes. Yeah. And it's aggressive language. Yeah. They were very angry at old King George.
It's funny because here in New England, that was received pretty well. You know, you had enough of the more radical contingents of the independence movement that have been talking about it, because New Hampshire had submitted its own declaration in January of that same year, right?
Right, right.
So it wasn't like, you know, blowing anybody away with, they're like, yeah, we feel that way too.
Mm-hmm.
But the further south you go, the more people are like, yeah, that's not... They weren't as comfortable with it. It really was, you know, like, what are we doing here?
Yeah, one of the favorite things I like to point out about the Declaration that I think surprises people. We have this. I think we have this image that when the Declaration was adopted, it was celebratory. But if you read some of the firsthand accounts of people who were in the room when the Declaration was adopted, they say it was a very somber and a very grim attitude because they believed that they had just signed their own death warrant.
Right.
And so that is something that, you know, we try to always bring out all of the perspectives, not just the romantic histories, when we talk to our guests. And that's something people don't really think much about, that they were actually committing treason and were at very real risk of being put to death for their crimes against Britain.
A lot of those images that come out from the Declaration of Independence being signed have just been like that romanticized version of it. And there's men standing around and they're presenting this document, and it just kind of falls into the minutia of American images, you know, what we're familiar with. And oftentimes confused with the Constitution being forged as well. People confuse the two.
Right.
Same setting, you know, same room, in fact. And a lot of the same people. But it was like it's just kind of like, July 4th, we do that. But you're right. It is... Have you ever seen the John Adams miniseries HBO did?
You know, I haven't. It's on my list. It's been on my list for a while.
They capture the feelings that you were just talking about very well.
Yeah.
They show them debating it through the night. It's not... No, also on that. You know, it's like they really get that across. And when John Dickinson stands up and gives his opposition to it, his fears, and then John Adams, you know, shows up his hope, they do a nice job balancing it out. And, you know, I don't know how much of that is word for word exactly what happened, but you can tell just from the way that that was early 2000s that came out, which, you know, kind of leads me to the last question that I have. It seems like you know, when you find things like this museum or just Revolutionary War history, independence, it's usually the 1970s.
Yes.
Bicentennial.
Right.
1990s. Where were we with people's understanding of the time period in the 90s?
You know, that's a really great question, and I don't have the answer. I was a teenager in the 90s, and it never really occurred to me to pay much attention back then. I think that it's always been a really romantic story. And it's only in the last couple of years that I think we've really, as historians, in the discipline and in the museum community, have really started to take a different look at the way we interpret this period of time, our founding, and really start to confront the fact that the revolution did not result in freedom and equality for everyone. And that, you know, there were black soldiers who fought for the for the Patriots, and afterwards were enslaved still. Yeah, and that struggle for freedom and equality has been ongoing for the last nearly 250 years. So we are at the American Independence Museum. We've been for the last couple of years doing research and trying to bring all perspectives to this story. And I think a lot of other museums are doing the same, so that we don't just have the mythological romantic story that we all had in grade school, but more of a balanced and truthful history of our founding.
I feel like that was underway in the early 90s. That
it
was
could have been.
Kind of the feeling of the 90s. There's another thing I brought today, I already packed it up, but is a book for kids from that time period called First Looks at, different periods in America. And it's all biographical stuff, it's about different figures. And the ones that they choose for the Revolutionary Era, Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, aren't in there. They, Molly Pitcher, who may or may not have even existed, it was chosen.
Right.
And there's a few others. And it's like, I think there was that, it's like revisiting of, for the 90s. And on my podcast, I've talked about the 90s a lot, because there seemed to be a responsibility felt by a lot of folks of like, okay, we're in the last decade of the, not only the 20th century, but of the second millennium. We have kind of a responsibility to usher in the new era responsibly and not to exclude anybody, and to try to, because Washington, Jefferson, Adams, they've all kind of been recycled, and in the 90s, that's where I think there's a lot more attention on, like, Abigail Adams.
Right.
Not just John Adams. And that's where I think, like, the miniseries is based on the book by the same name that, was written in the 90s. So it's like, it's the same events have always, it's all historiography. It's like the same event took place, but you can learn a lot from about what value was extracted in the time period that interprets it.
Absolutely.
So this building really says that.
And that's so, you can learn so much about history by how history was written. And it, we have this sort of tradition of talking about, like, Jefferson and Adams as these mythological figures. Yeah, they were stoic in the face of this incredible, extraordinary circumstance they were in, and they were honest and virtuous, but they were human. And I think a lot of their own stories, we do a disservice by not treating them as human. So that's really what we're trying to do here at the Independence Museum is, not only telling the heroic stories, but also telling the parts that aren't so romantic and that are darker. But not to vilify anybody, just to let people know that our founders were human and they were in a really extraordinary time. And they did some amazing things. They also did some things that weren't so great, but they were human like that.
And they set, Declaration of Independence obviously is essential to the country existing. But the Constitution, because a lot of people overlook the Articles of Confederation. They're just like that was the original Constitution. And that really reflected the Declaration's ideals much more. It was about states being their own countries and just kind of being related to each other, not having a... But it was the Constitution that was the one that not only solidified the Declaration and its ideals, but set the scene for, okay... So, like, every time it's been amended is a reflection of that time period.
Yes.
It's like, so women's suffrage is a reflection of the early 21st century. And I don't know if they're going to be firing right now, but end up on the podcast. Listeners are probably hearing the kids drilling right now, which is kind of cool. It's like they have... It just kind of works out that way, where it's like you can treat, as I always say, everything, a museum, a constitutional amendment, a entire town, as a document of its time. So
absolutely.
I'm so grateful that you took the time out of your busy, your cornerstone day.
Of course.
To talk to me about this.
Great talking to you.
I will wish all the listeners, make sure that you seek out, if you're ever in the seacoast of New Hampshire, seek out the American Independence Museum. You'll not be disappointed at all. Have a great day.
We now head back to the original colonial capital for the last segment, and back to Prescott Park on that wonderful, drizzly, windy day in June. Erica McAvoy heads the Moffett Ladd House Museum, which was the home at one point of William Whipple, a New Hampshire Patriot leader and signer of the Declaration of Independence. It was also the home of an enslaved man, Prince Whipple, whose story is just recently getting the attention it deserves. We began by talking about a Portsmouth captain of industry from 100 years after the Revolution, brewer, hotel mogul, and politician Frank Jones, but allowed the conversation to take us on a tour of Portsmouth's magnificent timeline.
Centennial. I hate to be doom and gloom about it, but that's just the way of it, right? And that's why I wanted to make sure I was going to be here, because it's an important 400th anniversary. So you chose from my table of pop culture Portsmouth artifacts, and it's a windy day, so it's kind of blown all of it, an image of the Frank Jones Brewery here in Portsmouth on Islington Street.
Yes.
And Frank Jones is probably about a century after William Whipple as far as his notoriety. Among other things, he was the mayor of Portsmouth, but here he's brewer and also hotel owner, so he owned a lot of hotels around here. And what made you choose this one?
Well, I like it because it shows the industry and also the railroad right in front of it, which was sort of tied together. It shows a couple active factories that you don't see nowadays in Portsmouth so much.
Yeah.
But it depicts a certain period of time.
Yeah, when it seemed like the industry was... That's right.
What do you think?
Do you think that's a cool picture? Do you like that?
Do you see the train at the bottom?
It is... It's like, so I guess the question I have for you is, who likely made it? And I guess we can say either the brewery itself,
right,
or that image, because the image is very busy.
Yeah.
It's like intentionally made to give. Do you think it was made for investors in the brewery?
It looks like it's showing, it's made to show industry. It's made to show off sort of what kind of Portsmouth had to offer at the time, I would say, as far as industry goes.
Yeah.
So it's definitely made to showcase the city, maybe made to showcase its technological advancements. Maybe it's made to showcase its transportation. I see the train, although it's not a transportation, it's not a passenger train, but
yeah,
an industrial train, but should have made to show its industrial advancements and its kind of growth.
It really reminds me a lot of those like panorama pictures you get from that same time period, where like every corner of the country had one as a way just to, it's almost like it speaks volumes about just the, like you said, the business potential of the area. And this is the era of, so we're looking at like late 1880s or so in this picture, probably.
Probably, yeah.
And that is the era of big business, right? Where it's all, like that's really like the origins of American business was that era of, instead of always relying on Europe for, you know, industry and manufacturing and, you know, capital, it was America self-sustaining it.
This was the Gilded Age.
Right, it was. And Frank Jones was like the leader in that, in this area of that. You know, when I teach local history to my students, I ask the question about people like Frank Jones and Ichabod Goodwin, who weren't quite peers. I think Frank Jones is a little bit younger than Goodwin was. But the question is, were they captains of industry or robber barons? And I think between the two, Jones seemed to be more of like a populist figure. Like people seemed to like him a little bit more, mainly because of the industry that he was involved in here.
Right. Who doesn't like a brewer?
Right, exactly. And especially, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, at the turn of the century, the Frank Jones Brewery was actually the biggest in the country. It was most...
So this makes me realize that I need to look into Frank Jones. I don't know much of him. Like I said, I'm new to Portsmouth. We came from Massachusetts, so I'm not too familiar with that. But it's interesting, the idea of, you know, captains of capitalism versus robber barons. And I almost wonder if it was even possible to be one or the other. If in that time, I feel like sometimes you had to be both.
Yeah, like it depended a lot on who was looking at you and what they were, how they would determine it. If it was, and I think there's a few pieces of evidence that stand out for Frank Jones. One would be his home. So that the house is still standing. It's up on Woodbury Avenue. If on your way to Newington, going to the Market Basket, you can see it's an apartment building now. But when he was living there, it had this massive park that just like swept behind it, and it had like peacocks and, you know, fountains. And I think it was 24/7. Anybody could come and walk around it. It wasn't like a private, you know, like only members or something like that. And there's that. And then when he ran for governor of New Hampshire, his brewery wrote a song about it. And, you know, so it was like a working man's tribute to their boss, basically. Yeah. And that doesn't really happen if you're considered to be a robber baron, you're, you know,
that's true. Yeah.
You know, stabbing the back of the working guy and stuff like that. But that particular picture, I love it because you're right, it's very busy. It's like it's really just showing all the activity in that part of town. And it's funny because that right about there is where the parade this morning just stepped off from.
Right.
Did you see the parade?
I didn't, no, but I knew where it was starting. Yeah.
It was, when I was a kid, like, that's one of those like pieces of history. The Frank Jones Brewery facility is one of those pieces of history that's just kind of like, it's hidden in plain sight.
Yeah.
Because people drive past it all the time.
Right.
Right behind, you know, in that plaza is where Hannaford is.
Yep.
And it's actually, I have another picture from the late 80s.
Yep.
This is the same plaza, Plaza 800. And we used to go to the Pick and Pay there, which is now Hannaford.
Yep.
And we rent our videos from Video 2000. And that particular building had a fitness center in it, kind of like the opposite of a brewery, in the 80s, called Off the Wall. And my mom would go there for aerobics, and I would go to the daycare center section. And it was like, I had no idea I was in an old brewery,
yeah,
you know, when I was like, over
right
there.
It's amazing.
And you wouldn't really have it now. Thank you so much.
No, we're having that issue across the street.
So, that little artifact, now at the museum that you work at, when visitors come to see it, what kind of, is it it's a house museum, but you also have things on display, is that?
Yeah, so, well, it's a pretty traditional historic house museum, so it's about, you take a guided tour, and it lasts about an hour, and inside you hear the story of the Moffat family that built the house as well, and they're a very interesting family that had a lot of interesting, dramatic, sort of, it's almost like a soap opera, except in real life. And then you hear about the people who lived there in the 19th century and sort of the changes that that came to the house throughout the years and how they sort of adapted it to the latest technology. We're working on an interpretation plan to talk more about, sort of add some more hands-on elements and family-friendly elements to the tour, but also talk more about the people who were enslaved there. So we talk about that a bit, but we don't know too much.
Prince Whipple,
he signed the Petition of Freedom in 1779, which was a petition to the New Hampshire legislature to end slavery. He and Winsor Moffat both lived there.
Yeah.
They both signed it. So
that piece of, I guess, quasi-legislation or attempt to make legislation, I think always stands out as a great document of its time as well.
Yeah.
Because, and it, I guess it would, 18th century pop culture, really, because the Declaration of Independence that had come a few years before really kind of laid the groundwork for future documents, including that one, which said, well, if all men are created equal, and all, you know, if freedom is, you know, why not us? Why, it kind of makes sense.
And what's interesting is that William Whipple, who signed the Declaration of Independence in 76, was living there at the time.
Yeah.
And Prince Whipple signed the Petition of Freedom 3 years later, so it's like you have these two very similar yet very different documents, you know, that are think equally important.
They almost like counter each other. Is Whipple buried over here
he's
in the Point of Grace? Oh, he's over on the other side of town with all the other people, his peers, basically.
Yes.
Well, I can't thank you enough for stopping by and being my very first guest. And I know, is there anything else you want to add to this?
Do you want to say anything else?
You want to say bye bye?
Bye. Say bye.
No.
Okay.
Bye.
Good job.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. That's documents. you know, that are, I think, equally important.
They almost, like, counter each other. Is Whipple buried over here
in
the point of
great...
Oh, he's over on the other side of town with all the other people, his peers, basically.
Yes.
Well, I can't thank you enough for stopping by and being my very first guest. And I know... Is there anything else you want to add to this?
Do you want to say anything else?
You want to say bye-bye?
Bye. Say bye.
No?
Okay.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Giving Tuesday is a primary source. These places are continual primary sources. What I mean by that is they are regularly adding to their experiences in order to stay relevant, making them documents of one time period to the next, even if their outward appearance remains basically the same. The current movement in educational experiences, such as museums, is to highlight the stories of those who for centuries have stood in the shadows. This falls to the essential problem that there are too few of what would be considered traditional primary sources available to learn about people who have ended up in the margins of the past. This is when seeking out and studying irregular artifacts proves its value. Giving Tuesday lasts just one day, but plenty of charities and nonprofits, such as the places chronicled on today's podcast, are glad to receive gifts and donations all year long so that they can fulfill their mission statements. And if you are involved in a museum or arts community, or really any institution, and believe, as I do, that podcasting would only enhance what you do, check out my podcast coaching and consulting opportunities at www.everything-history.com. We'll talk to you next time on the EPS podcast, where everything is a primary source.